The conflict in Libya is many things, but it also underscores how dangerous it is to be a foreign correspondent. A Libyan broadcaster killed on Saturday, an Al Jazeera cameraman killed earlier this month. Thankfully, though, the New York Times journalist captured last week by Libyan forces, Anthony Shadid, Tyler Hicks, Stephen Farrell, and Lindsay Addario, are now free, not before a harrowing period where they were roughed up and tied up. Michael Camber is also a foreign correspondent for The Times. He's just back from covering the war in Afghanistan. He's with us from NPR New York. We want to talk about Afghanistan, but Michael, first, your thoughts on Anthony, Tyler, Stephen, and Lindsay being free.
It's just great to have them out. You always think that, well, they'll probably be okay, but, you know, there's always that chance that you're going to get some really bad news.
Right.
And it's just wonderful to have them back.
Well, in some of your writing, you know, I was thinking that in your reporter's notebook, you write about coming around the corner in, I think, some way station somewhere, some airport, and around the corner is, I think, a Japanese photojournalist that's a friend of yours. You just bump into each other.
Tara.
And then, you know, each takes a plane on your separate way to some sort of danger. So I'm sure this is reverberating for you.
We have these odd relationships where we're really close friends. We've actually only seen each other in war zones. So it's kind of a weird brotherhood and sisterhood.
Yeah. Well, you were with us most recently to talk about the Marines in Helmand Province in Afghanistan and the terrible toll that those bombs buried in the sand were taking on them. 100 out of 1,000 Marines you informed us, coming home without a limb. Your latest story focuses on the problem of brickmakers at ancient kilns in Afghanistan, whole families, kids, who are literally indentured servants. Why? Explain this math for us. Explain the cycle that they get caught in.
Basically, these people go to work, usually at very young ages, in these kilns. Frequently, their father did it or their grandfather. As they get older, there's one of two things that happens. Either they inherit their parents' debt, and then as they get older and they want to get married, marriages in that part of the world are very expensive. People only make a dollar or two a day. So they borrow money, or they have a medical bill, so they borrow money from the kiln owner. It could be a few $100 or $1,000, but even a few $100 is impossible to pay off when you're only making a dollar or two a day. They basically get sucked into this cycle of debt where the kiln owner literally owns them, and they're not allowed to leave. They're not allowed to work for anybody else. If they do, the kiln owner will track them down and bring them back.
Because he considers them almost property. I mean, you talk to the kiln owners, and they, you know, recognize this equation that, you know, they borrow money from me, then they have to pay me back, but I pay them so little that they can't pay me back. But they rationalize it by what? By saying, well, I give them housing.
They're basically just mud huts. Some of the kilns have electricity part of the day, so, you know, they can charge their cell phones. You know, they're sort of a safety net. Again, you know, if you're very, very poor and you live in a remote village and your kid falls sick, he might die. But if you work in the kilns, you can go to the kiln owner and get a small loan and go to see a doctor. So it helps to keep them alive, but really in the meagerest of circumstances.
Well, the insidious part is that, as you said, this gets passed on, almost inherited, you know, this relationship with the kiln owners. You made a video for The Times. We'll have it on our website. And it's in some ways beautiful. You know, the kiln is all earth tones. They're using these ancient techniques with this, you know, clay to make these bricks. But you spoke to one of the sons in a family. I think he's about 18. And you spoke to him through an interpreter. And here's what 18-year-old Nick Muhammad told you about trying to leave the kilns. He wanted to join the army, but having to come back.
This job was difficult. I could not do it anymore. I got very tired of it. I spent 3 to 4 months in the army. Then I got the call. Hey, your father can't work fast enough, and we loaned him money, so I had to come back here.
So again, he's inheriting his father's loan. But remind us why this work is so hard.
They're frequently 12 to 14-hour days. You're outside. They start before dawn. It's still dark out when they start, and they work until really the sun goes down. And especially in the winter, it's freezing cold. They're basically squatting in the mud all day long with their bare hands. They don't even have gloves. Mm-hmm. They've got their kids out there. You can see that the kids' hands are all swollen and cracked and just awful.
One little kid tells you he made 2,500 bricks, which were then sold by the kiln owner for about $160. The family gets about 10. And what I found eye-opening was that thousands of these bricks go to NATO because of the construction boom. You speak to human rights workers. Can't anyone in the coalition in Afghanistan sort of force some human rights issues if, in fact, they're, you know, putting money into the equation, if they're buying some of these bricks?
When I spoke to them, what they said is that they're buying materials locally from local contractors, and they're doing that to try to spur the economy and bring money into Afghanistan. They don't directly hire any children, but of course the contractors go out and they buy the bricks that are made by kids, and they supply them to NATO, and it's sort of not their responsibility.
Well, and you also speak to people who say, look, you know, we could try to shut these down. This is, you know, slave labor, child labor, but then they wouldn't have, as rough as it is, a home over their heads and a blanket or a job.
Believe it or not, you know, there are many, many people in Afghanistan who are far worse off. So they actually don't want to see them shut down.
And what does this all say to you, Michael Camber, about the bigger problems the U.S. faces as it tries to, you know, fight the Taliban, bring the country into some kind of modernity? You know, as the Taliban is there to offer, you know, kids money to do things. So what does this one story say to you about the bigger picture?
I think there's just so much work to be done. And the idea that we can shut things down in a year or two and close up shop and go home, I really don't see it, not if we're going to make a real difference in people's lives. I think there has to be a more concerted long-term effort.
Well, and just to leave with another image you leave us with from your reporter's notebook, a separate piece of writing, where you talk about American troops who are looking around Afghanistan, and they say it's like we're on the moon. It's such a different place from where they come from. And there may be a disconnect, you know, between these villagers making bricks and this one sergeant who talks to you about saying to local villagers, look, you think what you have is nice. Where I live, I drive my car up to a house, I press a magic button, and a door opens up in the side of my house, and I drive my car inside. Where I live, my car has its own room, so if you would just stop shooting at us, you could have that too. I can't even imagine an 8-year-old making a brick, even knowing what he's talking about.
That's part of the sometimes slightly surreal nature of it. You'd have to travel the world far and wide to find a place more distant from our lives here in the U.S. So it's kind of fascinating to see these 18, 19-year-old American kids, most of whom don't have passports and have never traveled, and they're in Afghanistan on the front lines, really trying to do nation building more than fighting. So it's a fascinating dichotomy.
We have rooms for our cars. That's Michael Camber of The New York Times. We'll link you to some of his work in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.